So the title of this evening's talk is Psychological Maturity and How It Aids Our Ability to Liberate All Beings. I've been thinking about this word for a long time, maybe even 10 years I've been thinking about this word and how it applies to myself. How am I, my thoughts in my head, how mature are they? Or how immature are they? And just sort of noticing that and seeing if I can gently nudge myself towards being a more mature practitioner, more mature person and a more mature practitioner. So I thought tonight I might go through just a few of the places where I notice immaturity in myself and little things that I've done about that. I think we often have got subtle motivations in our words and in our actions that are not always completely wholesome, but we don't always really notice that. They're very subtle, and it's kind of fun to look at them and go, why did I say that? Why did I respond that way? You know, and just sort of check it out a little bit and not be annoyed with ourselves if it's maybe an unnecessary comment or statement, but just to kind of go like, that's interesting. I noticed that about myself. I just tried to elicit praise. or I just tried to elicit sympathy. I wonder why I did that. And just to find it interesting, you know. And I think when we just do that, we're more able to, next time, maybe not do it, but not be suppressing anything. So the whole process is a kind of gentle, kindly, but a little bit firm, because we are all here, we're all Zen Buddhist practitioners, so we've made certain choices about what we value in life, so a little bit of firmness is okay, but more sort of firm in the same way as a parent is maybe a little bit firm with their child, but doesn't get angry with their child. Just a little bit firm, like, no. Come, don't be so close to the edge, that kind of thing. When I get invited to give a talk, almost always I just straight away know what I'm going to talk about. And it just flows out onto the page pretty quickly because I guess I'm here a lot, so my mind is always working on something. It might be related to one of the classes we have, like the Monday morning or Tuesday morning breakfast class, or something from Jewels in the World, our monthly Thursday evening class, or the koan group on Fridays at 1 o'clock, or something that's come up through the sutras that we chant, or just something in my life. But there's usually something. But I noticed this time that it didn't flow so quickly. So I thought, I had the idea about maturity, but other than that, it wasn't flowing very well, which was unusual. So I thought, okay, what is happening in my mind, what's happening with me, what is not completely at ease with me, that this talk isn't flowing out onto the page? And I realized that I had these, not loud, but distinct, judgmental and arrogant thoughts in my mind about something. And I thought, this is getting in my way. This is why I can't work out what to write, because I'm aware that I've got this slightly judgmental, arrogant thought, and it's not wholesome to have this thought. There was nothing to be done, so the thought was just being unhealthy for me. There was no action to be taken. It was just repetitive judgmental thoughts. So I did something that's just sort of simple and gentle. I went to my teacher in Dokusan and said, I'm having this is happening. We didn't need to talk about it for more than a few minutes for just that process of sharing, like not pretending that I didn't have these thoughts, just sharing it like, this is happening. And then they were just able to kind of drift off, and then I had no trouble after that. Like, I want to talk about this, I want to talk about that, and it all flowed out, so. That's the whole spirit of, I think, the way to work with unwholesome is even too strong maybe, but just thoughts that are just a little immature or just a little not beneficial to yourself or to others. Just to be gentle with them, but do something about it. So I looked up the word maturity in the dictionary, and this is a few things that it said. An ability to respond to the environment in an appropriate manner. And then I won't go into it here, but I had that thought about, well, what we do here a lot is we examine what is the environment, what is reality. We examine that a lot here. So how do I respond to this unknowable, vast reality in a way that is appropriate? Which, from a Buddhist perspective, appropriate would be possibly to help alleviate distress in others, and to see how intimate we are with all things, that the boundary between us is just an illusion. So then another part of the definition was being aware of the correct time and place to behave and knowing when to act. Well, that sounded like a lot of what we do here too. We look at appropriate responses. Maturity includes a clear comprehension of life's purpose, directedness and intentionality, leading to a sense of meaningfulness. And certainly in Zen, the strongest part of one of the strongest parts of meaningfulness for us is the Bodhisattva vow, to relieve the cries of the world. So to do that, we need to kind of free up room in our mind to not be thinking too much about ourselves in these sort of ways that are not particularly beneficial to anyone, like ruminate a little less. So I've just put together a small list of some of the thoughts and behaviours that I've seen in myself that I don't think of as particularly mature, and maybe just some examples of them, just because it might be interesting. And then near the end, you know, maybe people could share, if you want, any of your immaturities. or your successes at, you used to be like this and now you're not, which I think is wonderful, because practice works. Practice works. So not needing, a mature person in general does not need to elicit sympathy. There's so many opportunities for us to elicit sympathy, and it's kind of nice not to do it. So when someone says, how are you? You can say, I'm good. Or you can say, I've had a really long day. And it's okay to say I've had a really long day, but part of that I've had a really long day might be that you're wanting the other person to say, oh dear, you know, are you okay? And then go, well, and then you could tell a story, and then they could sympathize with you. And that is all right, but it is nice to not do that in a habitual way. You know, nice to do it when you need to do it, but not just do it out of habit. So that's one thing I've noticed with myself, practicing not doing it out of habit, as if I have some need for people's sympathy, you know? Because when I think of someone like Kuan Yin or any of the great leaders that we've had in the world, you don't think of them going around kind of trying to elicit sympathy. You think of them not doing that. They're worried about you. Are you okay? They're not wanting you to, praise them or to soothe them or anything like that. Not needing to elicit praise for oneself or one's family. And I noticed when I sort of stopped posting on Facebook praisey type things like, my son won an award, which I did used to do, but I don't do it anymore. And that's kind of nice to not do that anymore. But it's still okay to do it. It's just an interesting experiment to think about not doing it. Just to try out what does it feel like to not elicit praise. I think I have a tendency to sort of brag a little bit, but it's a little bit playful, so maybe it's not too harmful the way I brag. Like, guess what I did? But I think it's got a playful quality to it. But if it is actually for the purpose of wanting someone to say, "Oh, you are amazing," then I think I've got a problem, and I'm working towards not doing that. I can remember one time where I wanted to elicit a little bit of praise. We had some burn marks on the floor from the charcoal exploding, and I painted it with this little gold paint, and I was pretty happy with myself. And I told someone, and they just sort of went like, oh. And I realized, oh, damn it. I was just trying to get praise. And it was really good that they didn't praise me. I really appreciated that. Also, eliciting approval. We often want to elicit approval from people that we, you know, hold in high regard, but it's kind of nice to not need their approval and not seek their approval. Another one that I think is incredibly helpful is to not try and be understood by others. I mean, it's nice when it happens, but it's actually really nice to not worry about being understood and even be okay with being misunderstood and not feeling a need to have to go, but I want to explain, that's not what I meant. To actually just rest with, okay, that's fine. I mean, if it feels like it's going to be harmful to be misunderstood, like particularly harmful to others to be misunderstood, then it's important to maybe say something. But if it's not going to harm anybody, but maybe just bruise your ego a little bit, then it might be, it's a good practice just to be okay with being misunderstood. I love it whenever I achieve it. It's a nice feeling to just be able to just go, oh, and not say, no, that's not what happened. To just let it pass, and it's okay. You know, you don't have to be understood. And I think a mature person doesn't worry too much about others' judgments of them. And I noticed a nice thing that happened for me a few weeks ago. I was opening a packet of incense, and I dropped the whole packet, and all of them broke except for maybe four sticks. And it fell, and they all broke, and nothing happened in my mind. Like, my mind didn't go, oh my God, what is somebody going to think of me? Or, I don't want anyone to see this. Or, nothing like that happened. It was just broken. So I just picked them up, put the unbroken ones in the vertical stand, and put the broken ones in the horizontal box, and they'll get used in the Dokusan room so they don't get wasted. But that's all that happened, and it was a very nice feeling to have nothing else happen in the mind except just only what was needed to happen. So we can cultivate that kind of simplicity in our minds. Another thing a mature person doesn't need so much is rewards, like daily rewards. At the end of the day, I made it through the day. Now I get to have my whatever. It's nice to practice not needing daily rewards. To be just moving comfortably through the world. Just moving comfortably through the world. The reward is simply to be part of this extraordinary place. That's reward enough. That we don't need to add another thing to that reward, like whatever it might be for people. We all know the common things. To just not need to embellish this incredibly beautiful world with a reward. And in the same way, to not feel a need to escape from this beautiful world. Even this beautiful world with all the pain, you know, not to escape, but to remain present to this world. Maybe another thing is not to need to feel that you are better or best. And I think for the spiritual practitioners, we can easily get into a little bit of that better, best thinking about ourselves. There's lots of, you know, cautions about that in our teachings. And another one is we don't need, as a mature person, we don't need to get caught in corrosive self-doubt. You know, it's not beneficial to the world for me to be thinking, I don't think I'm good enough to do this. I think Zen is too hard for me. I think these teachings are too tough for me. That doesn't benefit the world to have self-doubt, that corrosive self-doubt. It's good for us to have the other sort of doubt, like, what is this? That kind of doubt, that's a beautiful, great doubt. That is a beautiful thing. But that corrosive self-doubt is not beneficial to anybody. So a mature person takes responsibility for their experiences. So I notice that when I'm starting to feel some discomfort about something, whatever it is, seeing if I can not project outward and place blame outwardly, and instead look at what can I do if this is uncomfortable for me, what can I do? Take full responsibility for my internal world. Take responsibility for my internal world so that I can be responsible to the external world in a beneficial way. Oh, and one little example of that that I think quite a few people here will be familiar with. In our morning service, we start the service by chanting all my ancient twisted karma, and we do it 3 times, and then we chant Buddham saranam gacchami, and we do a set of verses that goes 3 times. And it's really easy to forget whether we're at the second one or the third one, or we're at the... Yes, it's really common. So one thing I've practiced doing, I used to just join in and I'd just be doing it, and I'd also be thinking about something else, and then I wouldn't know if we're on the second or third one. And I'd have to wait for someone else to cue me in, someone else to remind me, oh, we still have one more to do. And in more recent times, I've made more of an effort to go, be very present to this. Everybody else might forget, and you might be the only one. So don't lose track. You know, don't lose track of this chanting. Be responsible to help this chanting happen successfully. And that's a nice feeling too, to do that. And then not tip too far, thinking I have to be the responsible one to make sure this chanting goes on course. But just gently think, I want to keep track of this for everybody's benefit so that we all do it without too many kind of little confusing pauses. So that's a simple example of being responsible to the larger community. Oh, and one other last one on this theme is that often in the short term we might not want to do something. Like maybe the alarm goes off to come into the zendo in the morning. We might just in that 3 seconds have this feeling, I don't want to get up. It's warm here in my bed. I don't want to get up. But in the big picture, we do know we want to get up. In the big picture, we know we want to be here in the zendo. We know we want to. Or it could be work. You might just want to stay at home, but you've got a job. In the short picture, you might not want to go, but in the big picture, you do want to go. And so I think it's very helpful to function in the world that we're always doing what we want. That we're never feeling slightly in a victim position of, oh my God, I have to do it. I don't want to do it. If we look closely, we probably do want to do it. Even if we don't on a very short-term level, we might not. But in the very big picture, we do. And so I think that that is a mature sort of place to be, to function always, that we are doing what we want to do. We are choosing. It's volitional. We are doing it. We don't need to blame anybody. Nobody's making us. Of course, there might be some circumstances where that is the case, that we are being forced. But probably for most of us here, most of us have, I think, a certain amount of privilege, and we probably do have a lot of volition in a very large part of our lives. So good to actually fully embrace the fact that whatever we are doing, we are choosing. We are choosing to do it. Oh, and there's a line in Song of the Trusting Mind, that I thought of in relation to all of this, in relation to our attitude towards changing aspects of ourself. When you try to stop activity to achieve passivity, your very effort fills you with activity. So I was thinking about that line, that this is not an effortful, it's not an overly active process, it's more just noticing. I notice that I am feeling a bit like a victim right now, and it doesn't feel very nice. Or I notice I'm feeling slightly arrogant right now. It doesn't feel very nice. We can often just go that far. We don't have to necessarily go much further than that, because I think all of us really want to be happy and want to be well and want to be of benefit to our community. So in simply noticing that we're doing something that isn't, I think that we will then naturally flow towards dropping that behavior or that thought. It might take quite a lot of repetition, but we'll get there. So there's a very well-known and beautiful koan that maybe can illustrate a little bit of this flavor of it being a gentle process. This book, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara by Ben Connolly, we are studying this in our Tuesday morning study group. So I'll just read this koan and then the comments that Ben makes about it. Yunyan asked Dao Wu, and most of you know this koan, I'm sure, it's a beautiful one. How does the Bodhisattva of compassion use all those hands and eyes? Dao Wu answered, it is like someone reaching behind her head for a pillow in the night. So I'm just going to read what Ben says here. Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is usually depicted with countless arms outstretched to help all the suffering of the world. And in each hand is an eye to see and be present to that suffering. The Bodhisattva has left behind almost every trace of her own karma through years of practice, but still some traces remain, allowing her to stay in the world and not forget how it is to suffer, not forget how close her life is to everyone else's. All over East Asia, people call on the image, idea, and aid of Kuan Yin when they face illness, death, divorce, and despair. Many, too, follow her inspiration to a life of love and service. And yet, although she deeply hears countless cries and extends her loving arms of aid ceaselessly in all directions, she is as relaxed as someone reaching for a pillow in the night. This describes a profoundly easeful, unself-conscious, calm motion towards making things better. The reason Kuan Yin can have the energy to use those thousand hands and eyes to help and intimately hear people in their smallest and most terrible sufferings is that each gesture of each hand, each experience of seeing suffering, is unbounded by self-centeredness. So in another way, you could say being mature is to be less self-centered, to expand our sense of self to be far, far wider, to include everybody. And that way we don't get so tired because we're not caught in a repetitive, small, caged way of thinking. We've got a much more expansive way of thinking. And I also wanted to read a koan from this book called The Flowing Bridge by Elaine McInnes. And some people here who have got a Catholic background might be particularly interested in this book. She's a Catholic nun, and she writes, and a Zen priest as well, and she goes back and forth with verses from the Bible and koans, and it's just beautiful. So this is a collection of koans called the Miscellaneous Collection, and I'm going to read one of them and just finish with some comments on this koan. In a well that has not been dug, water is rippling from a spring that does not flow. There, someone with no shadow or form is drawing the water. So I'm going to read her comment on each line, and then I'm going to add some comments to each line. So this is Elaine's comment here on the first line. Usually a well has depth and circumference, but this well has not been dug, so it has no depth or circumference. Can you feel your intellect rejecting that well? Is a well any less a well when it hasn't been dug? Only an undug well is a koan well. So over the last couple of weeks, we've had Patrick and Kathy give talks where they talked about sentient and non-sentient. And the non-sentient world is always teaching us. The non-sentient world is constantly calling our name. There is nothing to be bored about in this incredibly abundant non-sentient world that is teaching us all the time. It didn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. It didn't have to get dug. It didn't have to get put. There is this well that is a constant source of nourishment for us if we let our eyes see it, if we let our ears hear it. So the second line, water is rippling from a spring that does not flow. This is Elaine's comment. The second line, water is rippling from a spring that does not flow. To say a spring does not flow is negating the very meaning of spring. Issuing forth from the ground is what makes a spring a spring. But with this spring, there is no issuing forth. The water here is from a spring that does not flow from a well that has not been dug. So my comment on this is that reality doesn't flow from left to right. And the suffering of the world doesn't flow from right to left. We just meet it. We meet what arises in front of our eyes. We just meet it. That is all we do. We don't have to search for it. We don't have to go off in that direction or that direction. Reality just is here in front of us all the time, all the time. And so much of the time our eyes are darting here and there, everywhere except right here, which actually, this has probably got nothing to do with this talk, but I'm going to say it anyway. Our dog, Jiao Jiao, can't see the computer screen. So when I put him on my lap to try and get him to talk to my daughter in Australia, I put him on my lap and there's the screen and his eyes just go everywhere but this bright screen right in front of him. And I think we're a little like that sometimes. We've got this reality right in front of us and we're going blah, 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 blah inside our minds and our eyes aren't seeing just what's right here. So the next line, there is someone with no shadow or form. And that someone with no shadow or form is exactly what this talk is all about. This mature person that has no shadow or form. So this is Elaine's comment here. The next line of the koan talks about someone who has come to the well, someone who has no shadow or form. Who is that person? You must sit until you know who that person is. No shadow, no form. As Dogen Zenji said, sit until your body falls away, until mind falls away. Shibayama Roshi said that you must sit until you die to yourself. A parallel in the Bible is the saying of the Lord, anyone who loses his life for my sake will find it. Will you find it? Find what? And then there's also a story that Elaine shares here. It's a story about the song of the bird. The disciples were full of questions about God. Said the master, God is the unknown and the unknowable. Every statement made about him, every answer to your questions is a distortion of the truth. The disciples were bewildered. Then why do you speak about him at all? Why does the bird sing? Said the master. A bird does not sing because he has a statement to make. She sings because she has a song. The words of the master are not to be understood. They are to be listened to as one listens to the wind in the trees and the sound of the river and the song of the bird. They will awaken something within the heart that is beyond all knowledge. So the last line of that verse is drawing the water. So I just want to go through it again. In a well that has not been dug, this reality is always here. Water is rippling from a spring that does not flow. It's just right here. There is someone with no shadow or form. This egoless self, this us who is just part of the whole catastrophe, is drawing the water. The drawing the water is the cries of the world. We go there with no shadow or form and we draw that water, we respond to the cries of the world. So I think that's all I have to say. Would anyone like to comment or ask a question or share some part of your immaturity or your maturity? It's all welcome. Robin. Thank you. That is a great story about how important it is to practice not taking things so personally and thinking that things are about us. And I think that's another good example of being more mature. We don't need to do that so much. We can, instead of focusing on ourselves, we can think more about others. As long as that's just flowing kind of naturally for us, like shifting the pillow behind our head in the night. We just do it. It's not an effortful thing. It's not a self-conscious thing. It's just attending to the simple needs around us. So, thank you. Arye.
Mm-hmm. And like the nature of the spring, the spring nature of the thing that's not a spring, mm-hmm. or the well nature of the thing that's not a well.
Mm-hmm. I'm being a mountain right now. Yeah, thank you. Kathy.
Well, I'm just reflecting on maturity, like in nature, and it's almost like I find that as I get older, and well, getting older doesn't necessarily mean we're maturing, but
that's true.
But there's also a way that the part that I do think is about maturing, and it's connected with what you're saying, is it's like not worrying so much. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, if there's challenges in our life, circumstances, then it's appropriate to worry. Mm-hmm. But I know that there's something sobering about just knowing that, you know, there's more time behind us than there is in front of us. And do you really need to worry about that? Do you really need to care so much about eliciting praise or all these things that seem so important? You get more of a perspective, I think, on what really matters here.
Yeah.
And so when I think about in nature, it's like the thing kind of becomes just more itself. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's part of our human maturity, too, that we just eventually allow ourselves to settle for, this is who I am. This is my life. This is what I have to offer. And I don't need to expend so much energy.
Yeah. Yes.
Things.
Yeah. I know a simple formula I use quite a lot around worry, which maybe people here know this one. Is there something I can do about it? Then go do it. And then don't worry. Is there something I can do about it? No. Then don't worry. And as simple as that is, it's very effective. You know, 'cause then we don't get into this repetition, which I think if we look at it closely, is self-referencing. We don't do that. There's a problem. Can we take some action? Yes. Then take the action and then let it go. Is there something we can do? No. There's nothing we can do about that thing. Then let it go. And you can sort of do that many, many times throughout the day or the weeks. Takes discipline, but that's part of why we do Zazen. We are training our mind to be able to drop something that is not useful and pick up something that is useful. Thank you. Thank you.
I think when you bring up wanting to be understood or defensiveness, the way you talk about it, it's so hard. Mm-hmm. I think the people that we don't know so well, I think it's not that hard. We can, maybe we won't see them again and it doesn't really matter what they think. People we're going to see again, sometimes we can see, or at least we can have a story that others are building up a story about us, and if we don't turn it, their story is going to get more solidified. Mm-hmm. And that could be this excuse, but I like it as a practice to like, well, we're all just making stories constantly anyway, mm-hmm. so even then maybe it's okay sometimes so that we can't know what other people are going to think or who they are or control the situation really anyway. Mm. But I think it is one of the hardest practices. Mm.
Yes. Yeah, I actually have been really enjoying being misunderstood. I know, truly, I've been really enjoying being misunderstood because it helps to dissolve my fixed ego. To be misunderstood. It's a great practice. So I would really encourage, if there's one thing that you could take from this evening, is to the next time someone misunderstands you, just let it be. unless it's harmful to them to misunderstand you, then it's different. If it's going to cause harm, then you need to set things straight. But if it's not going to cause you harm, just let it be and see how that feels. Someone thinks badly of you or something, that's okay. It's all right.
Yeah, I don't know who it is. Jean told me once of there's some teacher who says that, someone of our teachers that's alive in our general community, that if you think you don't have an ego, and you know people are like, oh, I'm past ego, I've mm-hmm. you know, I've gone beyond, then just experience being what you perceive to be falsely accused.
Yeah, it's great, that's what I'm
and
saying.
There it is.
Yes.
If you want to know your ego, mm-hmm. that's it.
Yeah.
You know.
And if you want to know how well your ego is dissolving, then that's a great place too.
Yeah, yeah.
To feel it.
It's so impossible to the ego. No, but I'm right. I know I am. You know. So strong. Ah, oh, there you are. Is that Linda Ruth? Okay, I knew it was somebody.
Yeah. R.A.
I think it's so interesting, the misunderstood thing also. I think it's sometimes, I think not always, but sometimes it's accompanied by somebody wanting you to do something differently. I think, for example, like I heard this example recently, like it was actually in association with Zen Center, like somebody was talking about somebody getting upset at them because they weren't like sweeping properly or something like that. And then that person got extremely defensive and upset, like, oh no, I know how to like sweep, I've been doing this forever. Or I think it was like actually about cleaning a bathroom or something. And it's kind of interesting, it's like sometimes, I don't know, it's just like maybe sometimes it's about not wanting to be, well, I don't know, it's, I agree with you, it's a really good practice to let go of stuff, but it's interesting. Sometimes it's accompanied by, I think, someone trying to get you to do something differently or do something else.
Mm.
And I think, not always, sometimes it's
like, yeah. This is what I think that we're doing. And maybe in those instances where someone's criticizing you or correcting you when you think it's not particularly valid, it might be even a more lovely practice just to do whatever it is that they say, you know, to even just, not even just accept it, but actually say, okay, and do it the way they say, even though that doesn't quite seem right to you, if it's not going to cause any harm. Yeah. Just, I think Renee had a question. Did you have a question?
No,
oh, you just, oh, okay. Oh, hold on, Sarah.
Practice of becoming more mature and not looking to get praise or sympathy, what I notice is that you become more aware of other people wanting to get praise or wanting to get sympathy, and I would basically not give that to them because I think, well, that's not really not the best thing for them, but should we be giving people the praise and the sympathy mm-hmm. that they are trying to get, or maybe try to open their mind and say, right now I sense that you're trying to get sympathy or praise, and you know, maybe try to, maybe that would open up a conversation on how to talk about what's happening inside of them.
Yeah, that's very interesting and subtle, I think. What to do when someone speaks in a way that they maybe want praise from you, whether to give it to them or not. And I think that's, you know, we've got a lot of teachings around skillful means. I think it really would depend on the person. If someone speaks in a way that they're wanting, say, sympathy, it might be just the right thing to give them sympathy, you know. But in another instance, it might be better just to go like, oh, okay, and not, you know. And I think that's a little tricky. We have to work that out and always do it from, not from a place of feeling any sort of superiority or something, that we maybe know better than them. I think in a way we just have to let it be natural. We just either naturally reach out with sympathy or praise, or we just find ourselves just going, oh,
what's appropriate.
Yeah. Prana.
Say, what
should I do here? If I say this, then blank will know blank. And it's kind of confusing to me that somebody would want to say, not tell someone else something about them, like purposefully hide something. And it's just, I realize that sometimes I have the same thing of this idea of how do I look if I say this, and not just the what is it that I'm saying.
And I think it's a great practice, as much as we're on one level we're wanting to dissolve the sense of a separate self, we also need to love this particular separate self at the same time. We need to love this particular expression, this nettiness here, this pranavness there. And in that sense, it's good to just be confident in ourselves and not feel the need to hide what's going on in our minds or hide our opinions. We just have to be skillful in our expressing of them. So, thank you. I think we are at the end of time, so we're going to have tea and cookies. I don't know if we'll do it inside or outside.
Inside.
Okay. Okay. So any merit that comes from giving and receiving of this talk, may it help us all mature like a nice fat plum just about to drop. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.